Good morning. I want to introduce our guest speaker. He's well known to a lot of you here, Dr. John Strastrimmer. Dr. Strastrimmer serves as the founding director of the Melanoma and Cutaneous Oncology Program at Lynn Cancer Institute, graduated the MD-PhD program at Tufts, and completed his dermatology residency at Yale. Following two fellowships, one in photomedicine at Mass General, and a second Mohs surgery fellowship at the Mohs College, he moved to Florida. He's adjunct professor of dermatology and research professor of biochemistry at FAU and associate clinical professor of dermatology at the University of Miami. He founded Dermatology Medical Missions, which treats poor dermatology patients in the Palm Beach County area and abroad, for which he received a presidential citation from the American Academy of Dermatology. He is twice named Physician Hero by the Palm Beach County Medical Society and awarded Man of the Year by the Florence Fuller Foundation in 2016. His topic today is dermatologic manifestations of internal medicine. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Strastrimmer.
Thank you very much. The title topic today was one that was requested be presented, and in all honesty, dermatology is manifestations in the skin that affect the body, either directly or indirectly. So we're going to give you 3 years of dermatology residency kind of fast. But I'd like to do this in a somewhat systemic way. So we're going to talk about normal skin findings that you'll find in some patients. So patients with chronic thyroid, renal, or diabetic conditions will have unusual skin problems that you can expect as part of managing these patients. So we're going to go through that. Then there are abnormal skin findings, which can be markers as clues to internal disease, such as infectious disease or internal malignancy risk. And then finally, I'd like to also make sure we pay attention to consultation cases, because this is really how we learn and how we collaborate. And these cases are cases that we see right here in our local hospitals that were seen by me and by my partner. So we're going to start with one of those cases. And this I would call the red and scaly patient. We're going to close this presentation with the opposite, which is a red and scaly patient with little teeny tiny findings. So both of these will illustrate the range of what we look for. So this is a 29-year-old man who had a 2-year pruritic eruption on his whole body. His past medical history, seasonal allergies, a report of childhood eczema, but no medications. So this patient is a challenge. You can see, first of all, the question arises, what's his skin color? You know, where's the diseased skin and where's the normal skin? And that can be difficult for us to find out right now. But what he has is the same condition as these other patients right here, who are also my own patients. So this patient in the middle has the same condition. Patient on the side there with the less red but a more peeling, diffuse rash on the back and on the palms of the hands. These all have the same condition. And this condition is called erythroderma. So erythroderma is a descriptive term for patients who have about 80 to 90% body surface area covered with erythema and usually fine scale associated with it. And so this is the spectrum of manifestations here. And these are our real patients right here that we take care of. And it's an important thing to address. It's also called exfoliative dermatitis. It might be cleared. Residents and medical students are always fortunately tuned to hearing about Steven Johnson toxic epidermal necrolysis when they see somebody with whole body peeling, scaly skin, but this is not that. Those conditions are more sudden onset. You have target lesions, mucosal involvement. This is basically erythema and scale involving most of the body surface, and it can be associated with telogen effluvium, which is sudden shedding of your hair due to the rest of the hair growth cycles as well. That's a descriptive term. It's not a diagnosis, but it's your red flag to say, this is a patient with erythroderma. What's my next step? These are all pictures courtesy of Google. And again, this shows the same thing. These look like very different patients initially, but what they all have in common is widespread redness and scale over the body, so much so that you could imagine that some of these patients, see if this pointer works, like this right over here, you can't even tell where normal skin would be, and it would be very hard to find out where a primary lesion would be. You know, where would be the clue to find your disease, because it's just kind of everywhere. So how do we take care of these patients? Well, the workup is a full skin examination, also looking specifically for lymphadenopathy, mucosal involvement, and hepatosplenomegaly. We try very hard also to identify if there's a primary skin lesion, such as nail pits that might clue us into psoriasis, or keratin plugs that might clue us into pityriasis rubropilaris as well. They do need a full laboratory workup as well, and we'll discuss the role of HIV a little bit later. And multiple biopsies. Again, it can be hard to tell what's the healthy skin and what's the non-healthy skin, so multiple biopsies of these patients. A very thorough review of medications, and age-appropriate malignancy screening, and these patients need to be monitored for hemodynamic stability. The purpose of the skin, the only reason skin exists, is to keep out bad stuff and keep in the good stuff. So with erythroderma, you are losing the good stuff. You're losing heat and you're losing fluids. These patients need to be closely monitored because they can become hemodynamically unstable, as we'll show you in one of my cases. The management for this condition is to remove whatever you can consider as possible primary cause, which can be medications, and those medications can be recent medications. They can also be long-standing medications. Monitor for hemodynamic stability, and we're going to treat them with topical mid-potency steroids and open wet dressings. So what's not in here? A Medrol dose pack, right? That's right. So I know a lot of you are going to reach for that, but it's not on here, and it's not in there for a reason. One of the reasons is that depending on the underlying condition, if you give systemic corticosteroids, you can actually exacerbate this condition. So we don't treat it this way, but we treat the underlying disease. This would be the best way to treat a patient if the patient were lucky enough to be hospitalized with this condition. This is called open wet dressings. And the way that this is done, it really has to be a dermatologist showing the nursing staff how to do this, or it won't happen. You just take a bed sheet and you soak it in warm water. You need to squeeze out all of the water until it's almost completely dry. That's placed over the whole front of the patient, and it's the convection, so it's the evaporation of the water that cools down the skin and helps to repair the skin barrier. That's the functional part here. It's not about putting on wet. It's that evaporation function that's helping there. You peel that off, and then you grease them up with your triamcinolone ointment. You flip them over and do it on their backside, and you repeat that every 3 hours. And you can see, you can take a patient from here to here, just in about 2 to 3 days. This right here is part of how we teach medical students and residents now when they come on rotations. So the American Academy of Dermatology provides an online self-guided self-testing module right here. So I put up just one of the questions right here about erythroderma. So which of the following treatments should take priority in any patient? Systemic steroids. We discussed that. That's not part of management. Oral antibiotics. Not necessarily. That's only if you think that there is an associated infection, which is not common. Topical corticosteroids, very important as we discussed, but the first part would be to get rid of any topical agents they might be using. So that could be even, it could be bacitracin, things like that, because that might be exacerbating the condition, as well as oral medications as well. So the categories of erythroderma, to try to figure out what's going on with these patients, fall into three groups. So exacerbation of a known skin disorder, for example, psoriasis, atopic dermatitis, seborrheic dermatitis, which is bad dandruff, greasy skin, can be in the body folds, is sort of a cousin of psoriasis, pityriasis rubropilaris, this is a very rare skin condition, and contact allergic dermatitis, a very common skin condition as well. The second category to consideration would be medications. And the third is, could this be either a malignancy itself, such as cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, or a manifestation of HTLV-1 disease, as I'm going to show one of my cases, or could it be a paraneoplastic manifestation of an internal malignancy disorder as well? So this is another one of my patients right here. This is a 35-year-old construction supervisor who was admitted not to this hospital but to another hospital in the area for hypotension. So he's a construction supervisor. He's a tough guy. And he showed up with this erythroderma, and he was found to be hypotensive in the ED and admitted to the hospital, where he stayed for about 4 days. His hospital bill went up to $70,000. He had a gang tattoo on, so it was very hard to get a dermatologist willing to come in and consult on the patient. And so he left AMA. We saw him in clinic and were able to address what was going on with him, partially by taking a history. He said, yeah, I have some psoriasis. I think this could be my psoriasis. Could be. And his diagnosis, therefore, was erythroderma secondary to his psoriasis. So the treatment for this patient is about $15 a month worth of oral methotrexate. So this is the patient when we first met him, and this is about 6 weeks later once he's on oral methotrexate. So we can treat patients that way. So this would be an example of the first category where we're exacerbation of a skin disorder, a patient with a known history of psoriasis who's manifested as erythroderma. Of note, one of the ways you can trigger erythroderma in a psoriasis patient is by giving them systemic steroids. Excellent. So that's why we don't do that. We don't reach for systemic steroids. That's absolutely right. Thank you. Second category would be medications. And there is a list of offenders on here of medications. And the medication history with dermatology eruptions is difficult because it can be something as early as a week or two prior to the skin manifestation. That could be the offending agent, or it could be a long-standing agent over years. But it's very important to take a medication history. And then we have a list of the most common offenders, so we can compare if the patient's on one of those as well. And also we need to be careful about things like plant pharmaceutical products such as St. John's wort as well. The last category of patients that falls into erythroderma is another one of our patients. We saw this patient on a medical mission trip. She's got diffuse erythema and scale. It's very hard if you're not used to looking at skin types 5 and 6, so that's usually African-American type skin, figure out what they do is red, but the patients will tell you that they're red and that this is not their normal red skin color. But she's got a very diffuse scale over her whole body, involving her hands and her feet as well. She had a history of diabetes type 2 and about 5-month history of pruritus and this worsening rash. She did have lymphadenopathy in her neck and groin. We took a biopsy, and the biopsy, which was suggestive for changes consistent with adult T-cell leukemia, and we confirmed that by serology, and this is actually HTLV-1 disease. So the third category of erythroderma patients would be those associated with a malignancy, such as a form of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma or HTLV-1 disease, or possibly as a paraneoplastic manifestation of an internal malignancy. So patients need to get age-appropriate screening for their malignancies when they present with this. So let's back to our original patient here in this case. And this is, as I said, this is one of our patients, walked into our clinic one of these days, referred by a primary care doctor. 29-year-old man with a 2-year pruritic eruption on the body, past medical history, seasonal allergies, childhood eczema, no medication. So the first challenge is to find out what's his normal skin color in these patients, and that can be a challenge. We decided that his normal skin color is actually this lighter skin color area right here, and not this darker one because this had more scale on it as well. He got a series of biopsies here. He's diagnosed with erythroderma. That's the clinical working thing. Biopsy was consistent with psoriasis, but in contrast to the other patient I just showed you with a bright red skin, he had no history of psoriasis. So this is a significant enough finding that I'm happy to say this is our first publication of 2019. This was published in New England Journal of Medicine a few months ago by my partner and by a very motivated medical student. This is a marker of HIV infection. So this patient was undiagnosed with HIV. And with HIV, you can have either a new psoriasis, they've never had psoriasis in their lives, but they develop it, or a dramatically worse psoriasis or other papulosquamous disorder. And this can be a manifestation. This patient was put on heart, and the rash resolved. So now let's move on to the section which are abnormal skin findings, which could be a clue to internal disease. These could be markers of infectious disease and of internal malignancy risk. So this is somebody's wrist right here. And if you look at these aren't round. Dermatologists, you know, we give everything shapes and colors, which are hard for other people to appreciate. If you think that the body is a Crayola box with different colors of beige, that's how we describe green and purple and brown and red and so forth. So this is purple, and it's polygonal. And you can see the patient has them on the flexor wrist, and then in the mouth has this kind of lacy erosion on the mouth as well. This is lichen planus. This you will all see in your practices. You all have patients with this. And they're called purple pruritic polygonal papules. So they itch. And they have a little bit of associated scale called Wickham striae. But what they characteristically do is they're in linear groups. So when you scratch your skin, one of your skin's responses is to produce interferon. And interferon stirs up certain skin diseases, such as psoriasis. That's why people get psoriasis on their elbows, because they're getting banged all the time. And in this condition, the scratching, you end up getting these bumps in a straight line, because you scratch, you get interferon in the straight line, and these rashes pop up within those straight lines right there. This is usually a self-limiting condition of 2 to 3 years. And we treat them topically, but we also, this is one condition where we do use systemic corticosteroids by tradition more than anything, but intramuscular triamcinolone does a nice self-taper for these patients. Some of the complications with these patients is that this can turn into mucosal squamous cell carcinoma. So in my Mohs surgery practice, I have unfortunately treated these patients who have turned into lip squamous cell carcinoma, very challenging to treat. There's also a variable association with hepatitis C. So this is a big part of our talk today, is talking about hepatitis C and markers of it and manifestations of it. So hepatitis C virus has several different findings that can be clues to it. Lichen planus, porphyria cutanea tarda, polyarteritis nodosa, necrolytic acral erythema, cryos, and pruritus as well. So if you look at this patient right here, your first thing might be the patient has athlete's foot, so we'll give her some fungus cream, but this is more on the tops of the toes, right? Athlete's foot, fungus is on the bottom, and maybe the sides. That doesn't quite fit. Could it be eczema? Well, eczema is usually more, you know, like the flexor parts of the body, not the toes necessarily, so that doesn't quite make sense, and the rest of her skin looks to be in pretty good shape. So you wouldn't do anything particularly wrong by giving a person a week or two of any of those topicals, but then if they're not getting better, you send them to your friendly dermatologist who can help get the bottom of this as well. So this is a condition called necrolytic acral erythema right here, which can be a marker for hepatitis C disease. Necrolytic acral erythema, this is a picture I showed you. This is from one of my colleagues from Mass General that he published in New England Journal of Medicine a few years ago. It is described as a psoriasiform eruption. In other words, you can convince yourself it sort of looks like psoriasis, right? Thick, scaly plaques. They're just in the wrong locations for psoriasis. So it's psoriasiform eruption on acral surfaces, hands and feet primarily. It is often a marker of hepatitis C, and it's believed to thought that it's a manifestation of zinc deficiency. It's part of what the virus is doing to the liver. There's less zinc absorbed to the bottom. And these patients, this case right here, was successfully treated with 2 weeks of zinc supplementation after an 8-year history of trying everything under the sun to treat this patient for psoriasis or atopic dermatitis. Another manifestation of hepatitis C disease is this condition right here. So the back of the hands, a lot of blisters, including some with a little bit of hemorrhagic crust on them as well, and some scars as well. You see scars, 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 scars. So on the back of the hands, back of the hands is the place where you get sunlight. So you might say, well, is this some sort of photosensitivity disorder? And it is, called porphyria cutanea tarda. So porphyria cutanea tarda is taught to medical students as an inborn error of metabolism, where part of the heme synthesis pathway is blocked, and those heme intermediates are very strong photosensitizers. So they build up in the skin, and they cause skin burns, which leads to blisters and scarring. It also can be a manifestation of hepatitis C disease, and we think it's because, again, the virus is doing something to tickle the liver to mess with that metabolic pathway. So these patients have vesicles on sun-exposed areas, particularly the hands, and what we really look for is this kind of, not just the blisters, but looking for the scarring as well. Most blistering disorders that we see in dermatology don't cause scarring. You all probably have patients with bullous pemphigoid, very frustrating condition, blistering condition, they don't scar. So this is unusual because it's scarring right here. Patients also have hypertrichosis. This is the so-called Wolfman disease. And they can have fragile skin with sclerodermoid changes, meaning that that scarring formation is getting to be so much so that their skin is really feeling to be overall very, very tight on their hands as well. The differential diagnosis is what we commonly see, pseudoporphyria. So this is a picture I took from the web as well, but this is really a nice typical picture of what pseudoporphyria shows up. It's not porphyria. So if you were to test the blood, they would have normal blood urines. It can be associated with kidney disease, but it is commonly associated with medications, particularly the NSAIDs and also oral contraceptive use. And if you look at this hand right here, there are fewer blisters than what we saw before, and commonly these patients you don't see the actual blisters. You just see the little bit of erosion where there once upon a time was a blister, and certainly the scarring would be a lot less in these patients as well. The next manifestation of hepatitis C we're going to talk about is polyarteritis nodosa. So this if you have a hospitalized patient that looks like this, this is probably going to get your attention, right? This is not venous stasis dermatitis because you've got this sort of marmorata pattern, this sort of zigzag, jaggedy edge thing. This means that medium or large sized blood vessels are taking a hit in the body. This kind of pattern like that. See, it's all kind of, it looks almost like big chicken wire pattern right there. This is something's going on with medium to large size vessels in the body, which can be very serious. So polyarteritis nodosa is a combination of small vessel vasculitis, which is palpable purpura, we'll show that in a second, and medium vessel vasculitis, which shows in this kind of livedo pattern right here as well. And you can actually feel these bumps under the skin. These are the vessels getting very, very inflamed themselves. And it's a multi-system disease because whatever's happening with these blood vessels here can be happening, blood vessels affecting the kidneys, affecting the heart, affecting the brain, affecting your nerves is a cause of monitoritis multiplex, for example. And it's a combination of, again, this medium to large vessel disease and palpable purpura. So for the residents and medical students, remember palpable purpura means you see little blotchy red things on the dependent areas of the body. So that's the legs. If they've been hospitalized for a week or so, it's not going to be on the legs. It's going to be the dependent part of their body, which is the rear end. So you look at the butt for these little red bumps. Close your eyes, run your fingers across them, and if you can feel them, that's called palpable purpura. If you can't feel them, that's called purpura. And purpura is something related to a bleeding disorder. Palpable purpura means there's inflammation going on there. So small vessel vasculitis could be due to drugs, could be due to a lot of different things as well. So with this polyarteritis nodosa, it's associated with hepatitis B or C, and these patients tend to be very systemically sick. So they could have urticaria, and they can be sick because of multiple organ hits. There are variants which are involve only the skin, but they're less rare, and there's a childhood condition which is associated with strep disease as well. Now, this looks a little bit like what we saw before, right? You know, it's not so much that chicken wire lacy, but if you look at these on the legs, this is something serious going on here. This isn't just a bruise, because if you were to feel it a little bit, this would be tender, and it would be raised. And this is cryoglobulinemia, also associated with hepatitis C virus disease as well. This is a 62-year-old woman who was sick. She has arthralgias, elevated LFTs, glomerulonephritis. And this cryoglobulinemia causes a small vessel vasculitis. Remember what I told you about before, palpable purpura. Close your eyes, and you can feel the little tiny bumps, as well as clotting in vessels, which cause that reticular pattern, or sometimes a direct hit to an artery, as you see here, causing true necrosis in the skin as well. They're systemically very ill, these patients, and this is cryoglobulins, meaning that they're reversible in these, if you put them in a test tube, and so it commonly gets the more cold parts of the bodies, hands and feet as well. And it's associated with hepatitis C, but also multiple myeloma as well. So let's look at this patient right here. The most recent consult I did here in Boca Raton Regional Hospital was for a patient who looked exactly like this. I didn't take her picture because of all the HIPAA laws and all this stuff, but Google has taken pictures, but she looked exactly like this. So you can see this is a patient with an eruption. We don't use the word rash, but you can. The patient has an eruption all over the place. And if you were to try to describe it with me, you'd go crazy. But what's the main thing that stands out in this? We look for things where they are involved and where they're not involved. So what's not involved here? That whole central part of the back. Now, I'm what people like to call double-jointed, right? So if I had this condition, my whole back would be all scratched up. I can scratch everything. Most people cannot. So this means that this rash is caused by something outside the body. This is not an internal thing spreading and landing in the skin, because then it would go wherever it wants to go. It's something from outside that is affecting this part of the body in here, and that is fingernails. So with pruritus, these are some more pictures of pruritus. So this is somebody who's got more kind of widespread all over up here, and this is somebody who's, this is pruritus on the legs. It's helpful to distinguish pruritus from one of these other true dermatologic conditions. Look, these are linear, right? You look for linear things. There are very few things in nature. No rash that comes from inside your body out makes straight lines. They don't. I mean, you could sort of have a dermatomal thing, but it's something external has to be straight lines. Maybe you got smacked by poison ivy. That causes a straight line. Maybe you got a jellyfish sting. That can be a straight line. Or fingernails, straight lines. And so this is pruritus in these patients right here. And the other part that's a key diagnosis with pruritus, it's why we look closely, is hemorrhagic crust. There are very, very, very few eruptions or rashes in dermatology where you actually see dried hemorrhagic crust. It's very rare for them to do that. It's almost always due to trauma, such as picking and scratching, or herpes infections can do those as well. So pruritus, these are areas that obviously we can reach in linear arrangement, multiple phases of healing, and hemorrhagic crust with them as well. They can also have sort of a later manifestation called prurigo nodules. So once you keep picking at the skin enough, it'll react and thicken up a little bit. You see these little prurigo nodules as well. And this can be a manifestation of hepatitis C. It can also be, there's a whole pruritus workup we do when we see a patient with pruritus to see if it's due to one of these internal diseases, iron liver malignancy, commonly Hodgkin's lymphoma, neurologic disorders, polycythemia, renal, thyroid dysfunction. And so they get a full workup as a dermatologist. And then if all of this is negative, then we consider calling it primary pruritus. And there are patients who walk around with primary pruritus, unfortunately. So this is not pruritus right here. Is this in linear arrangements? No. Do you see a lot of hemorrhagic crust? No. So it's not pruritus, but this itches like heck. It's an itchy condition. And this is dermatitis herpetiformis. So dermatitis herpetiformis is a condition that of symmetric group vesicles on the extensor surfaces, commonly the elbows, very, very itchy. And it's associated with thyroid conditions, lymphomas, and dermatomyositis as well. These are due to IgA antibodies that specifically target one of the components of the epidermis. And a lot of patients have associated gluten sensitivity in these patients as well. Another non-pruritus condition. So this you all have seen. You all have patients with these. This is going to be very frustrating. This is bullous pemphigoid. So again, you don't see. If you look at this right here, you might say, listen, Dr. Strassmayer, you said hemorrhagic crust. That looks like hemorrhagic crust. That's not. That's not a bloody scab. That's dried. That's serum, right? That's yellow scab. So in dermatology, we really distinguish those colors. And it's got these very loose bullae and blisters that are forming right here. Usually older people, usually on the flexor surfaces, usually spares the oral mucosa. And with this condition, we first need to rule out whether this is due to a drug reaction. There's a form where we don't find any bullae, but you just see this kind of background of the pink erythema there. And it's an eosinophilic-mediated diseases. We treat them with systemic therapy, usually one of the tetracyclines and nicotinamide. And if they do need corticosteroid agents, we also will start very early on steroid-sparing agents. So that could be also help if you're having trouble controlling one of these patients. Your dermatologist should be able to get them on a steroid-sparing agent as well. The next part of this talk is going to discuss the normal skin findings in chronic disease patients. So we're going to talk about thyroid patients, renal chronic disease patients, and in diabetes. Okay. So hyperthyroidism is, the way I think, I'm not an internist, but I think about the thyroid as being the thermostat for the body. Everything's kind of revved up. And when it's revved up in the skin, you get too much stuff in the skin. And that too much stuff in the skin can manifest as thyroid dermopathy, also called pretibial myxedema. So when you look at these, it's kind of, these are called coalescing waxy papules and even vesicles because they're fragile. They can burst a little bit. And if you biopsy, it's too much stuff in the skin. In this case, too much hyaluronic acid in the skin. A possibly more major manifestation of the same idea of too much stuff in the skin is scleromyxedema, which are these coalescing waxing papules commonly around the eyes and around the face, which is increased hyaluronic acid in these patients and also increased fibroblasts. So not just deposition, but also increased number of fibroblast cells as well. And the upper chest is a good location for this as well. And then the biggest ramp up of too much stuff would be generalized myxedema, which is a diffuse deposition of hyaluronic acid, chondroitin, and this is the so-called non-pitting edema in the legs. So normally edema in the leg is fluid, so you push it, it'll pit, and then it'll release. This one will not pit because it's just basically like a mattress stuffing there. It won't pit. They tend to have too much stuff all over their body, so the lips tend to be swollen, the nose is swollen, macroglossia, puffy eyelids, hands and feet, and it can lead to nerve compression problems as well. Hyperthyroidism can be associated with autoimmune diseases, such as this patient up top here with vitiligo, pernicious anemia, and some connective tissue diseases as well. So on the other end of the spectrum of thyroid conditions would be the hypothyroid conditions of the skin. And some of the nonspecific changes you'll see is there's not enough stuff going on. So the skin isn't properly working. It's not maintaining its proper barrier like it's supposed to. So you'll see a xerosis on the skin. The skin is not flaking off the correct way it should be. So it kind of builds up and makes these kind of thick, scaly stuff, palmoplantar keratoderma. In other words, the skin's not revved up enough to shed like it should. You kind of sit there like a snake building up all this thick stuff as well. People can lose, we describe a loss of the lateral third of the eyebrows as well, and they can have other ideas of poor wound healing, poor blood clotting, and keratinemia as well. Okay, diabetes is very, very common, and I'd like to go through some of the skin findings your diabetic patients will probably have, which just need to be expected as part of managing their chronic diabetes as well. In general, and please forgive me, I understand that we don't use the term type 1 and type 2 diabetes anymore. I rely on my internal medicine residents to keep me up to date on that, but I didn't update the slide about that as well. But the type 1 patients tend to have more autoimmune lesions, and the adult onset ones have more cutaneous manifestations. This can sometimes be the first presenting sign of diabetes. So we're going to talk about some of the skin diseases that are associated with diabetes, cutaneous infections with diabetes, and cutaneous manifestations of complications of diabetes, and then what actually happens when we treat diabetes. Is there anything special that shows up on the skin? So about 30%, a lot of patients will have these findings on the skin right here. So they're diabetic and they have these little brown spots on the skin that might be a little bit indented. And the term for this is diabetic dermopathy or shin spots. We think this is probably just due to banging your shins and having poor wound healing in diabetes. And part of poor wound healing is you get hemosiderin, which is from the blood. The red blood seeps into the skin, basically as rust, and it stays there, and it takes years for it to go away. So that's why they're left with these dark spots. Patients hate this, and there's not a lot to do for it except to keep them from stop banging their skin. And it might be because there, as part of the diabetes, there is increased risk of microvascular disease. So these are more fragile blood vessels in the skin. Diabetic patients can get diabetic bullae. So this is not necessarily, you need to call your dermatologist because you think you've got a patient with bullous pemphigoid, although we're always happy to see them. But this can happen. These are bullae on usually a non-inflamed base. Remember the bullous pemphigoid, bright pink base. This is non-inflamed base. And we think, again, this is probably just because the skin is more fragile and it's gotten traumatized and created these bullae as well. Acanthosis nigricans is associated with diabetes as well. So the skin is a little bit too thick, particularly in the body skin folds and around the mouth as well. And we think that what happens is that the hyperinsulin state, the insulin binds directly to keratinocytes and stimulates the growth of these keratinocytes. And that's why you get more stuff in the skin as well. It's also found a lot of patients who are just obesity. If you have a dramatic presentation of this, you would need to be concerned about underlying gastric carcinoma. But it can also be secondary to some medications, pineal tumors, and other endocrine conditions can be associated with this as well. Diabetic patients also can sometimes get a condition called scleroedema, diabeticorum, which is a sort of a peau de orange on the upper back. So you kind of close your eyes and you can feel it, and it feels kind of, you feel it almost more than you see it because it's a little subtle light orange color, but you feel it, and there'll be a very firm podorange in these patients as well. More commonly is NLD, necrobiosis lipoidica diabeticorum, which are these spots, these wounds that are on the legs that are atrophic. They have a lot of telangiectasias, meaning that they're atrophic, so they're kind of sunken in. You can see here this is healed with some scarring right there, and that's a wound right there. Telangiectatic, meaning they've got extra blood vessels around them as well. And patients, not all patients have diabetes, but this can be a marker for diabetes in patients as well. Diabetic patients, probably as part of their associated with other lipid dyslipidemias, can have eruptive xanthomas, which are crops of firm, non-tender papules with a little bit of redness around them, mostly on the extensor surfaces. This is associated with a very high triglyceridemia as well, and this can be secondary to alcohol and also to estrogens. Diabetic patients are at high risk for getting candidiasis, and candidiasis manifests usually in intertriginous areas. Candida loves moisture, and so any patients with problems with intertrigo. Intertrigo is a descriptive term. It just means red, irritated skin in a body fold. Can be due to chemicals, can be due to seborrheic dermatitis, can be due to candidiasis. First thing you have to do is get those areas dry. But once they have real candida, the key finding are these little satellite regions. So this is not just red that's kind of spreading out and stopping like, say, a groin fungus would do. It's not spreading with a rim of scale at the edge like fungus would do. Instead, you've got these little satellite lesions because candida loves to dive into hair follicles. So any place you have a hair follicle, the candida will go in there and set up shop as a new little island in these areas. It also can manifest as angular chylitis. I get that condition. I have a droopy mouth, and so a little bit of saliva builds up there, and occasionally I get a cracked lip right here, and that's just candida buildout. A little bit of topical nystatin goes away in 2 days. But in patients with diabetes, they can get that much worse. And they also can get a lot of fingernail problems, chronic paronychia. So that's where your cuticle of your nail doesn't properly seal anymore, and lots of germs and irritants can get in there, and your fingernails start growing out in a very funky fashion. That can be part of diabetes as well. And a similar kind of condition in between your toes or your fingers, if you wash a lot of dishes, called erosio, where the skin cracks open and a variety of germs set up shop there, also more common in diabetics as well. Erasma can also show up in diabetic patients. This is a commonly in the body folds like here. It's a well-demarcated brown or red patches. If you happen to have a woods lamp laying around and you turn it on, this is going to fluoresce a beautiful coral red color. And this is just a buildup of too much corneal bacterium, and we just treat it with a topical antibiotic agent. A very rare finding, but very deadly problem in diabetic patients is mucormycosis. So this is typically identified in patients with ketosis, and it involves the higher portions of the nasal mucosa. So it involves the terminates, the septum, the palate, and the sinuses as well. So they present to being very ill, headache, fever, lethargy, and nasal congestion, and the mortality rate is very high, 15% to 34%. So the treatment is correction of the ketosis, some surgical debridement, and then usually intravenous antifungal agents as well. The last part of talking about diabetes are the cutaneous reactions to insulin. So patients will come to you in your office. My mother recently had an exacerbation of her diabetes due to a steroid requirement. And so she was telling me she had lumps all over her tummy. So I actually pulled up my old slides and I showed her my old slides. She's a retired physician. And we looked at this together. So insulin by itself can actually do two different things. So insulin can cause lipoatrophy. So as a result of the injection, you can get areas of depression, but those are usually a little bit further down the road. But it can also cause the opposite effect, lipodystrophy, where you get sort of lipomas forming at the areas where you get a lot of injections as well. And you just basically treat it by changing where you're doing the injections and also patient reassurance as well. Okay. Renal failure is a condition we see in dermatology because we see a lot of patients for consultations because there's a whole slew of problems that people with chronic kidney disease have. So we end up seeing them frequently in our offices. They can have cirrhosis, pruritus, pigmentary changes, hair changes, and so forth. This is a manifestation which I think is only ever shown in these type of formats. Usually it's a picture taken off the internet, like this one here, because we don't see this anymore, uremic frost. Because to get uremic frost, you really have to have your BUNs up very, very high. And fortunately, here we're able to usually keep people under better control. And this is reported to be more common in the pre-dialysis era as well. We're going to talk about some specific changes that happen in renal failure, the perforating disorders, bolus disease of dialysis, calcinosis cutis, and calciphylaxis, and nephrogenic systemic fibrosis. So what are perforating disorders? These are some of the most interesting conditions we learn about in dermatology. So this is your body, your skin extruding, for whatever reason, normal skin components. So these little things can be made up of collagen. They called reactive perforating collagenosis. They can be made up of keratin. They can be made up of a mixture of things as well. But these are seen sometimes as a manifestation of a kidney disease. So when you see patients with something like these, your first tendency might say, well, is this a bunch of warts? Well, warts are more flat-topped. And if you've ever had warts or had somebody with warts, they wouldn't be kind of so discrete. Warts tend to grow as one big thing and kind of spread out. Sometimes they make a little donut because you froze on them before. So you could think about warts with this, but this would be an unusual location for warts. These are commonly on the extremities, warts, you know, fingers, toes, feet. But this is a perforating disorder of kidney disease. And as I mentioned, they have these exotic names, but it's basically skin stuff getting extruded through the skin as well. Bolus disease of dialysis happens, we think, because like in diabetic patients, the skin is more fragile, and with all of the fluid shifts of somebody undergoing dialysis, it can cause them to create these bolae. It's not dangerous. This is not bolus pemphigoid. Again, if you look at the base is not inflamed right here, and we treat them by taking care of this, you know, maybe lancing it, draining it. We don't remove the surfaces of bolae, right? That's the world's best bandage right there. If you just cut a little window to let the fluid drain out and you put it back down there with a nonstick covering, this will heal beautifully for the patient. A sad long-term complication can be calciphylaxis. So calciphylaxis is, again, remember before we saw what I was calling like a chicken wire appearance of the blood vessels on the skin, that means something is hitting those medium to large size vessels. So this is really an exaggeration of that. Right now, something is hitting it and actually killing the skin. That's necrosis there. That means these vessels are completely blocked off. The arterial vessels are blocked off right here. And this is calciphylaxis. And this basically is an arteriopathy, which leads to gangrenes. And these are angular, very painful. Arteries often travel with a nerve. So anything that is an artery hit often is more painful than a venous type hit. And it has a very high mortality as well. Last finding, we're not seeing so much anymore, but this happened to have appeared precisely when I started my dermatology residency, and I was lucky enough to work with the person who first coined the term of nephrogenic systemic fibrosis, which is a diffuse sclerosis of all of the skin and the deeper tissues, including the fat and the muscle as well, which can happen in renal failure. And it causes terrible contrasters, and it's thought to be due to a very specific radiography contrast material, which is no longer used. So let's look again at some more interesting local cases. Now that we've gone through the big categories here, and we have a few minutes left. So this is a first case is a 51-year-old male with a history of hypertension and diverticulitis who had worsening myalgias and arthralgias for about 3 weeks. So he just wasn't feeling well. And then he started getting severe lethargy and fevers for about a week. And he was admitted, he went to the ER, got some blood work, he's found to have hyponatremia. So that was a justification for putting him in the hospital. As can happen, dermatologists consulted because they had a pigmented lesion on the abdomen. You know, somebody looked at him and said, "So you have a melanoma." Not sure that would be a cause for his other findings or his hyponatremia, but we're always happy to see patients, and all patients get a full skin examination as part of their dermatology consultations. So his vital signs were more or less stable, but he was found on his exam to have elevated white counts, elevated CRP, and a low sodium. On the skin exam, he's found to have multiple tender. Remember, tender things in dermatology, there aren't very many things that hurt when we push them, so those always get us interested. Very small, 1 to 2 millimeter erythematous purpuric papules, okay, on the palmar side of the fingers and the dorsal aspects of toes. So remember, so this is a type of palpable purpura, right? So they're purpuric, and when you touch them, it hurts the patient, but you can also feel them. This is palpable purpura, so not bruises. Something more serious is going on in the patient right now. And no mucosal findings. And these are what they look like. So little tiny purple spots on the fingers and on the toes right here. Another one on the toe here right now. So differential diagnosis in this patient is that these are Osler nodes or Janeway lesions. And we're going to talk a little bit about the difference between those two. And this could be secondary to, most likely case, bacterial endocarditis. But the other causes where you can find these are systemic lupus erythematosus, gonococcemia, and hemolytic anemia diseases. So this is a biopsy taken. Usually we would not biopsy these. We would make the clinical diagnosis that we have Janeway lesions or Osler nodes. But the patient got a biopsy. Now the biopsy actually had some nice telltale findings of thrombin in the vessel wall and endothelial cell obliteration and something that looked like a dermal abscess, so perhaps something infectious going on here as well. So the patient, as part of the admission, and these findings on the skin, the patient got blood cultures, which grew out Staph aureus, and then eventually became negative with treatment. An MRI on his back showed he had an epidermal abscess, and a TEE showed he had a vegetation on the aortic valve with an ejection fraction of 65%. So this is a patient with bacterial endocarditis, which was identified because of these small findings that we have here. These patients can also have petechiae, splinter hemorrhages. Those are the dark linear things that are in the nail beds, Osler nodes, and Janeway lesions. And the distinction is Osler nodes kind of hurt, and Janeway lesions don't hurt. And if you look in the eye, you get something similar, retinal hemorrhages called Roth spots. This diagram has a summary of the different kinds of findings that you'll find in patients with bacterial endocarditis. So subconjunctival hemorrhage, Roth spots if you can get a fundoscopy, sometimes petechiae in the mouth. The clubbing is a manifestation of somebody having sort of a chronic heart condition, right? This is not an acute finding in this patient right here. Splinter hemorrhages right there. Petechial rash, remember this could be petechial, meaning you close your eyes, you run your fingers over and you don't feel it, so not palpable purpura. This could just be little tiny bruisings as a manifestation of it, and the Osler nodes and the Janeway lesions. So these Osler nodes and Janeway lesions are, as I said, also seen in SLE, gonococcemia, and hemolytic anemia. The Osler nodes are tender and they're raised, and the Janeway lesions are non-tender and hemorrhagic, and people do discuss when you see one versus the other, but it doesn't really matter. They're kind of a spectrum of the same thing. We think that it's either a circulating immune complex mediated vasculitis or a microembolization, that the actual vessels are taking a hit themselves. I just put up this picture right here. This is a picture of our patient right here. You can see this spot right here. This is, you know, kind of purple with a red base right here. So this is the colors we look for. This is not red. Again, I just want to draw your attention to when you're looking at skin things, you got to really take that 64 colors that are in the Crayola crayon box and put them all within just the spectrum of different skin tones. It can be harder to see. This happens to be a patient who had a cholesterol embolus, another patient, to his toe. Okay. A very interesting case that overlaps my primary clinical practice. My partner is a medical dermatologist who thrives on lupus. So if you ever have a lupus patient you're not sure what to do with, we love lupus in our practice. I love complex skin cancer patients. So this is a 45-year-old woman who works in construction who has a history of SLE. And you can see she's very fair-skinned, works in construction outdoors, good reasons to have a lot of skin cancer on her. And in fact, on this arm right here, she had a big, thick, scaly stuff in her arms, which was biopsied, called squamous cell carcinoma. And when I first saw her, she had seen a plastic surgeon who was going to perform a degloving procedure to remove the whole back of her hand, which looked like that, to get rid of all that skin cancer. And this part right here, he thought, well, we can't really get that at this. That would be too much to cut all that off, so let's just radiate her instead. So when we saw her, a couple things came to mind. So all of you see patients with skin cancer. Everybody's got skin cancer. Now, have you ever seen a skin cancer that looks like this? Right, so skin cancers don't really grow as rings. I mean, maybe if you had like one long-standing basal cell, it could kind of just grow out as a ring. But they don't do that. They don't grow as rings. And these are kind of polycyclic rings all sort of together as well. But the pathologist said it's squamous cell cancer, so I guess we have to cut her off and radiate her. Or not. So we re-biopsied this several times and sent it to a very good specialized dermatopathologist who ended up coming with a diagnosis that this is just simply a form of her lupus of her skin. So not squamous cell carcinoma. This is actually a form of subacute cutaneous lupus erythematosus manifesting like this as well. And the patient was successfully treated with photoprotection and emollients. So no surgery for her. Just really good photoprotection and emollients, and she's gotten better with that as well. So that's a little bit the overlap between internal medicine and skin cancer. So you wouldn't think that we have, why is a Mohs surgeon giving a talk on internal manifestations of disease? Because it affects everything that I do, whether I have patients on systemic therapies, such as systemic 5-FU for eruptive keratoconiomas, it affects everything we do. This is a last patient case for us to go through right here. 40-year-old, otherwise healthy man who had a rash on his groin for 9 months, and it wasn't getting better with antifungals, antibiotics, or steroids. And he was admitted for altered mental status. So he wasn't admitted for the rash, he was admitted for altered mental status, but he sort of had a rash, so they thought to consult dermatology. And yes, you can see he's got some erythema, a little bit of scale, his gluteal fold and his buttocks. He's got maybe what you call a geographic tongue, which is a general, nondescriptive term, not very helpful, not a specific marker of any diseases, but he had that as well. And then again, if you look at his legs, it looks like he's got some sort of eczematous process, right? He's got sort of scaly, erythematous skin, sort of on the legs and arms, but also a little bit in some of the flexor areas, like behind the knees area right there as well. And unusually, on top of the hands. So this is a condition that looks sort of eczematous-like, but then the distribution is not good for eczema, right? We don't see eczema people with things on their knuckles. People with eczema get it like on the sides of the fingers and other parts of the body. So very unusual distribution of this in the setting of somebody who's admitted for altered mental status. What the heck could be going on here? Get more showings right here. This is, again, the flexor part of his skin here. Flexor part, this is the groin area. More involvement right here. So the differential diagnosis in this patient could be atopic dermatitis. So if this patient had a long-standing history, like since childhood, of atopic dermatitis, it could be. But it sounded like he wasn't responding to the usual treatments for those. Could be necrolytic migratory erythema called glucagon syndrome that we're going to get into. Acrodermatitis enteropathica. Zinc deficiency. This is actually a childhood disease. This is a genetic disease of childhood where kids can't absorb zinc properly. So they get this kind of eczema, but it tends to show up around the mouth as well as the hands and the feet. He's too old for that, so that wouldn't be true. Could be pellagra, you guess you would think about. That's the typical Casals necklace on the upper chest right there. Or an unusual variant of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma or tinea, but he didn't respond to that as well. So his laboratory's findings were significant for elevated LFTs, and also some specialty labs were ordered. So his zinc level was normal, vitamin C was normal, but he had very elevated insulin, C-reactive peptide, and markers of some tumors. On his imaging studies, CT of the abdomen showed a very enlarged liver with hepatic masses. So this is a skin biopsy right here, which again really takes a very expert dermatopathologist to find anything helpful here. But you can see, normally this part of the skin up here should be clear. You shouldn't have all these cells going all the way over. This is perikeratosis. And then also, right at the junction of this layer of the skin, you have these very unusual cells, which are called buckshot disc keratosis. Very, very subtle finding. And this is necrolytic migratory erythema, which is a glucagon syndrome. So this is a biopsy of his liver, which showed a tumor, and these tumors secrete too much insulin. But I just told you this type of rash is characteristic of a hyperglucagon state. So why Is he getting that if he's got an insulin-secreting tumor? And that's where I would love to ask one of our medical students who's at FAU, but I don't think we have the back-and-forth way to do that right here. And so what happens in this patient, he has an insulin-secreting tumor and then a reactive hyperglucagon state as a consequence of this condition as well. And so I know we have students at FAU and residents as well. It's an immense pleasure to work with them. I work with both the UM residents who are in the MD-MPH program here throughout the county, as well as FAU as well. And we work very hard with them. These publications you see right here from me all have a first author as either an FAU resident or a medical student. We also get them involved very much in our medical mission work, both locally, helping out at the free clinics here, and also our overseas work as well. And I'd like to thank all of you very much for your time this morning. And I'll be happy to answer any questions. If you want me to look at spots, we should probably wait till everybody else leaves and find a more discreet place. Yes, is a question. Yes.
So one of the features that this pathology or that can lead to this kind of confusion, whether it's squamous cell or cutaneous.
So the question is, how do we end up with this confusion between squamous cell carcinoma and lupus? So skin lupus, if you have a patient with lupus in the skin can show up as some of the acute lupus findings, right? Like the malar rash, that's due to too much sun sensitivity in the skin causing kind of a sunburn reaction. You can have the other end of the spectrum of lupus, discoid lupus, where you get a lot of atrophy of the skin. And then in between you have a condition where the skin is overactive, and those are called the subacute cutaneous lupus erythematosus, where they get thick and scaly. So they get thick and scaly kind of like psoriasis, is a thick and scaly condition, but they when they get thick and scaly, they grow in that cyclic pattern. So it looks like chicken wire. So that's the first clinical clue for that as well. But quite honestly, this is a very difficult diagnosis because that extra thick keratin layer can become invasive. So it's pushing down into the dermis just like squamous cell carcinoma can. Because of the crazy growth pattern, the cells can look very atypical as well. And so you really rely on somebody who's very familiar with the skin biopsy manifestations of lupus to help guide you in that condition. And we're very fortunate to have had that in this otherwise very complicated case. Thank you. Okay. Well, thank you all very, very much.